Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Founded by Bunker in 1972, Barefoot College teaches illiterate men and women to become solar engineers, water drillers, midwives, doctors, dentists, architects, masons, and blacksmiths. By acquiring sophisticated technical skills, women and men who might have otherwise been written off by their villages become empowered and instrumental members of their communities. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
Your career doesn't seem like a logical extension of your privileged upbringing. How did you choose this path?
I went to a very snobbish, elitist, expensive education in India. And you couldn't be more cut off from the real India, from the education I received. And it was just out of sheer curiosity that I went to a famine in Bihar in 1965, which was devastating. Thousands of people were dying of hunger, and there was misery and poverty everywhere. And so it sort of changed my life, and it shook me because that part of India I'd never seen.
You were 20 years old at the time.
20 years old. It really shook me to the extent that when I came back home, I told my mother that I'd like to live and work in a village. And she went into a coma because she just couldn't understand what had happened in 14 days. And she just said, what is all this? You know, your whole life is laid out for you. You have the choice of being a banker, a bureaucrat, a diplomat, a doctor, teacher, and what are you going to do in a village? And I said, actually, I want to be an unskilled laborer digging wells. She was a bit of a snob, so she said, what will I tell the family? That you're going to dig, you're going to be an unskilled laborer digging wells. I said, actually, that's what you're going to tell them. So for 5 years, I was digging wells under the stars in the middle of the desert of Rajasthan. And that's where I learned how to become a driller. I did my master's in English, so it was quite useless for what I was doing in the village in the middle of nowhere. But I learned about compressors, and I learned about tractors, and I learned about drilling, and I learned about deepening wells. And it was at that time when I was, those 5 years of living in a village in the middle, just under the stars, that I came to meet some extraordinary men and women in the villages of India.
You mentioned that curiosity brought you to this rural village to see this famine, and you decided that you wanted to make a life in this area. Was there any part of you as you were growing up that was resisting the upbringing that your parents were providing?
I was quite normal till I went to Bihar. The sort of line that they had planned for me was almost classically traditional and conservative. And until I went to Bihar, I had no idea that I would rebel. I was amenable to the lifestyle and to the environment I was being brought up in.
What did your parents do in Delhi?
My father died very early. My mother was the trade commissioner for India in Russia.
And how rare was that, to have a mother who was a career woman?
Very rare.
How did she become that?
She struggled, and she was discriminated against, and she had had a rough time to get to that position. But I think the fact that she was very, very honest, to the extent that she created a lot of enemies within the system, she fought that single-handedly. She knew how to fight. She was a fighter. But this whole world of living in a village was totally alien to her. And it was something that just she couldn't understand.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the school teaches hands-on skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to illiterate women and men. So you spent 5 years in the village learning from these people. At what point did you say, you know what, I want to institutionalize this, I want to create Barefoot College?
My real education started then, in the villages, when I was living and working with them. very ordinary people yeah. with such extraordinary skills and knowledge which they kept to themselves, which they kept in the village, and no one has actually ever thought of using that knowledge and skills for their own development. And I thought I would like to start a college only for the poor. It would be a college with a great difference. It would reflect the lifestyle and work style of Mahatma Gandhi.
What was his view of the villages of India?
Gandhi said that you must first identify the knowledge and skills of people in the village first for their own development. And if that was not enough, then you take knowledge and skills from outside. He thought that the solutions to India was developing the villages of India. And if you could develop the villages of India and make them into a productive, balanced, secular, equitable society, then you wouldn't have people leaving the villages and going into cities.
And this focus on self-reliance or self-sufficiency,
self-respect, self-esteem, all these.
When you decided to take this ethos on and started the college, how much resistance was there, if any?
There was resistance because it was something new. It was something which we were trying out on a small scale. It was something where a lot of people were saying this wouldn't work because, you know, everyone thought that Gandhi is now almost outdated in India. His lifestyle, his work style, his simplicity, what he taught about accountability, honesty, all these things are unfortunately very alien now in India. But the Barefoot College, because of this exposure I had with all these people who were living and working in the villages with me, they said one major thing that you mustn't do in the college is bring in people with paper qualifications. Anyone with a degree or a MSc or a PhD is the only college in India where you're disqualified to come.
So what are the qualifications to be a student at the college?
You have to be someone who lives and works in a village, very remote, inaccessible village. Has to be someone who lives on less than $1 a day. It has to be someone who has a skill which can be recognized, applied, used on a large scale for the development of their own communities. So that's why we call it barefoot, because barefoot is symbolic of millions of people who live and walk barefoot in India. We are showing that it is possible to develop people who are very poor to use the expertise and knowledge and skills that they have. For instance, just by way of an example, rainwater harvesting. If you ask an engineer how you solve the problems of drinking water in Rajasthan, they will say, drill a hole in the ground and take water out of the ground from 300 feet and put in a hand pump. This is what we did from 1979, from up to 1979, 72 to 79 we did this, and we said, hold it. We are putting in hand pumps and the water is going, and we are going deeper and deeper. Why don't we look for an alternative? So we went back to the elders of the village and said, what is the alternative? They said, why aren't you collecting rainwater? Because for hundreds of years we've been collecting rainwater. So we changed our policy and actually listened to the elders, and now we're collecting rainwater harvest. Now that's an alternative. We are saying that this is a supplementary but an alternative of how you mustn't waste your resource. If you see how people live in the villages of India, they live simply. They respect sun, they respect the land, they respect the rain, they respect the wind. That respect is internalized in their lifestyle and the way they live. So the Barefoot College says, why aren't we listening to them a bit more and just listening to how they are solving their own problems? And the drinking water problems in Rajasthan is that you collect rainwater on a large scale, whether it is on the surface or you collect it on the roofs of the schools. So we are collecting about 100 million liters of rainwater in 1,200 schools. That is how we are saying that a low-cost community-based solution is already there. You listen to the people, see what solutions they have, and see how you can scale it up on a large scale.
Is literacy a prerequisite for teaching or learning in the college?
Even without the written or spoken word, you can make people into solar engineers just by sight and sound and sign language. We keep asking, where is it written that just because you don't know how to read and write, you cannot become an architect or you cannot become a dentist, or you can't become a solar and water engineer, or you can't become a traditional midwife. Where is it written? So we don't penalize anyone just because he can't read and write, or she can't read and write. But you can always use the expertise that you have as a dentist, or as a traditional bone setter, or as a traditional midwife. These are people we ourselves call professionals. These are all professionals because they've been respected and accepted by rural communities, highly respected, and they use the expertise. Why not capitalize on that and bring it into mainstream? So that's what the Barefoot College does. We say that these skills are universal. It's been there for hundreds of years. When the Barefoot College gives it the respect it deserves, it gives it the platform for them to show what skills they have. And it's a challenge for lots of people to say, look, if they're doing it this way, why aren't we doing more of this?
The Barefoot College has a campus in India, in Rajasthan, that's 80,000 square feet, that was built by barefoot professionals, illiterate architects and construction workers. Tell me a little bit about that.
There are 12 barefoot architects who don't know how to read and write today who actually built the college. We built it at $1.50 a square foot. In 2002, the Aga Khan gave us the Aga Khan Award for Architecture to the barefoot architects. But then we had a controversy there because they felt that an architect with a paper qualification must have been involved. We said, yes, he was involved in making the blueprint, but everything in the blueprint contains the knowledge and skills of barefoot architects. So you have to recognize the barefoot architects. So they were humming and awing. So we returned the award for the first time in the history of the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. We returned the award because they didn't believe that the barefoot architects could have made such a marvelous structure.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the school teaches hands-on skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to illiterate women and men. In 2010, Bunker was recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. We'll hear more from Bunker coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Founded by Bunker in 1972, Barefoot College teaches illiterate men and women to become solar engineers, water drillers, midwives, doctors, dentists, architects, masons, and blacksmiths. By acquiring sophisticated technical skills, women and men who might have otherwise been written off by their villages become empowered and instrumental members of their communities. In 2010, Bunker was recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Now, the Barefoot College has been an innovator of solar electrification. How are you the innovators of solar energy?
Because the sun shines in Rajasthan, it's so commonsensical that you're not using the sun. We have 45 kilowatts of panels on the roof, which for the next 25 years, I have no problems with power. My telephone exchange, my electronic mail, 700 lights, 700 fans, 40 computers, 24/7 works of solar power. But the beauty is that this was installed by someone who is a Hindu priest who has only done 8 years of schooling.
How come you were among the first to use it?
I was actually being prevented from using it because everyone kept on telling me how expensive it is. I said, look, this is the future. Solar is the future for Rajasthan, indeed the world. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what we need to do. And to show to set an example, let's solar electrify the whole Barefoot College. We did it slowly. But we wanted to show that all the appliances that you need, basic minimum needs, you could do off solar. You could have lighting of solar, you could use your email of solar, you could use your telephone exchange of solar, you could have lights of solar, you could have your community radio that we have of solar. You could edit your own films off solar. So we wanted to show the different appliances that solar energy could be used for. We also said you could cook off solar. So we have a parabolic solar cooker on top of the roof of the college, which feeds 60 people twice a day. The parabolic solar cooker was actually fabricated by four grandmothers who don't know how to read and write. And to have a woman to fabricate a sophisticated solar cooker is something that has is a very powerful message.
What percent of the barefoot professionals who are educated through the Barefoot College are women versus men?
60%
are women.
What we wanted to show was that women are equal or even more superior to men in non-traditional areas where women shouldn't be. So we started training women how to repair hand pumps, a totally man job. They said, oh, what are you doing? You know, women, they are too weak. They won't be able to lift this thing. This we did in 1984. It was a breakthrough because the government of Rajasthan, which is so traditional to women, couldn't believe that a woman could actually repair a hand pump. We wanted to show a woman could also be a solar engineer. Why only men? The women, fantastic the way they pick it up. So it's repairing hand pumps, making women into dentists, making them into water chemists, looking after computers, feeding in data and computers, making them into solar water engineers, making them rainwater harvesting. All these were men's jobs. But we said, we want to open it up to women and let's see how they do it. Fantastic.
To what extent did your mother's will and profession influence your belief that women were just as capable?
It wasn't my mother, it was my wife. Very powerful woman. She definitely kept me in line.
When did you get married?
1970.
Where did you meet her?
I met her in university. And she was in a premier government service, in the Indian Administrative Service. And she resigned in 1974 and then joined the Barefoot College for about 3 or 4 years. Then she found that she couldn't stand me as a boss. So she said, I want to do something else. So now she's a street fighter. And she's very, very famous in India.
What is a street fighter?
Someone who takes the issues of corruption, accountability, transparency of governments onto the street and show that these people really deserve to be treated better. She believed that development would be one way of changing society, but the other way would be to campaign, to get communities mobilized and involved and sensitized on this whole issue of the right to information, how people are very secretive in India, and how you need to open up the books of government to show that how the money is being spent. And there was resistance all the way. There are two very important policies, laws that have been passed by government in the last 4 or 5 years, which she was instrumental in. This was the right to information and the right to work. This was something which she was responsible for.
What is her name?
Aruna Roy. So I am Aruna Roy's husband in India.
Incidentally, did your mother ever come around and see what you were doing and form a different opinion about what you were doing?
Well, she came around when the Prince and Princess of Wales came to the Barefoot College for a day in 1992. Took a while.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India that teach practical skills. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the schools teach hands-on technical skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to mostly illiterate women and men. What were some pivot points in the growth of Barefoot College that really kind of changed the trajectory of the college's progress?
Barefoot College has gone through several crises. Political, lots of politicians wanting to close it down, lots of resistance to the ideas of the college training women, lots and lots of crises.
What's an example of a crisis that led to, you know, a critical pivot point?
I was actually being investigated by a whole government who was against the Barefoot College, and the whole political leadership of the state was actually against the Barefoot College, because I had actually thrown out one of their politicians who would, for corruption. So I survived that after 4 years of very hard campaigning by the government to close me down.
What year?
In 78, 79.
So it was more a personal vendetta that the government had versus opposition to your system.
That's right.
In 2002, you received $1 million from Jeffrey Skoll, from the Skoll Foundation, which is based in San Francisco. What did the college do with that money?
So we said, if this can be done at the Barefoot College, why don't we promote and encourage a decentralized, demystified approach to solar, like we've done in the Barefoot College? So between 1990 to 2004, we actually solar electrified 600 villages in India. Then we said, and we, what did we learn from that experience? That it is possible to promote this Barefoot College outside India. And I went to Africa in 2004 with the support I got from Jeff Skoll. We also had other sources, for instance, the Norwegians. They wanted us to go to Afghanistan. So I went to Afghanistan in 2004, 2005, again with the same approach. Why don't we select women? And of course, when I went to Afghanistan, they said, out of the question. So I said, how do I get the women to India? They said, you have to take the husband along. So I took the husband along. So the husband and wife came for the first time.
From Afghanistan to India.
From Afghanistan to India.
How many?
Three remarkable women with three remarkable husbands came to India in 2004, 2005.
Did they need the Barefoot College to realize and prove their remarkability, or did the villages know that they were remarkable and that's why they were chosen?
They did not have any idea of how remarkable they were until they came out of the habitat. And they were challenged in a completely different setting. They didn't know the language. They didn't know the people. Strange clothes, strange weather, strange food, strange locality. First time ever coming out of this remote village in Afghanistan. And they became solar engineers. And they went back and solar electrified the first five villages ever in Afghanistan in 2005. I made a film on this. And I said, the cost of taking these three men and women, six men and women, bringing them to India, training them for 6 months, buying 150 solar units, transporting, insuring, installing them in 8 months total, was the cost of one UN consultant sitting for 1 year in Kabul.
You trained three women to become solar engineers. What are the network effects of that?
Those three women have trained 27 more women in Afghanistan and solar electrified 100 villages. The best solar engineer I've got so far is a 55-year-old grandmother from Afghanistan. She solar electrified 200 houses for me in 2005. They're still working today in Afghanistan.
We mentioned that you received capital from the Skoll Foundation and from... Was it a Norwegian philanthropist?
We have got from the Dutch Foundation. We've got something from a French Foundation. We've got something from a UK Foundation.
Your approach to taking in money is also a Gandhian approach.
Yes, we will not take more money than we need.
What is that Gandhi quote?
The world has enough for every man's need, but not for one man's greed.
Was there ever an example of your taking in too much money and it leading to trouble?
Never. We only take that much money that you can spend wisely and properly and be accountable for it and show how we spent it. We actually, because of my wife again, we actually have a public hearing on our organization and how the money has been spent, where it comes from, and how it has actually reached the villages. It's not enough to have an audit statement. It's not enough to produce annual reports. You have to actually take that information down to the people in a simple, communicative way and show how the money has actually been spent.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. What, just stepping back as you look at the life you've created, what has provided you with the most satisfaction?
Seeing a non-person becoming a human being in front of your eyes in 6 months is an extraordinary experience. Seeing a grandmother who comes from 28 countries around the world, nobody, and they go back like tigers. They go back like they are veterans. They walk out of the plane as if they can take on the whole world. It's an extraordinary experience to see some of these grandmothers who've gone back home.
In addition to teaching practical technical skills, you're also teaching them self-confidence and self-respect.
And self-esteem, yes. We are. Because we are, for the first time, giving them a skill which is required in a village, which can be applied in a village, and which can have an impact in the village very fast, very soon. So usually we don't have long-term programs designed for villages. We have programs which have an immediate impact. A rainwater harvesting takes only 4 months, a tank to make. We have a solar electrified village you can do in about 4 or 5 months. It has to be within a very short span because people are restless, people are impatient, and there's an urgency here. So if you tell me, give me a 5-year plan, this is useless for me. Why should I wait for 5 years? I have to do it now, now, now. So have you got something for us now, now? So the solar electrification, the night schools, the rainwater harvesting, the employment generation that we do with all the handicrafts that we market for them is now, now, now. It's always now, now, now.
What is your view of people who don't have tangible, physical, practical skills?
We tend to value the paper qualification more than the person who has practical skills today. And unfortunately, the rural areas of the world are depending too much on people who have paper qualifications than practical skills. And I think that's the wrong way to go. And I think this is a disastrous way to go. We don't have enough opportunities available for people who are not a part of the formal educational system. What you call the dropouts and the cop-outs and the washouts. They're all there in the villages, all there. What have you got for them to remain in the village? You have a very serious problem. If you don't do it enough, fast enough, they're going to migrate into the cities and be social problems for you. All these slums that you have in Delhi and Calcutta and Mumbai are all people who have not been given the opportunity. So if you can develop that skill on the spot, which are practical, functional, and necessary in a village, why should anyone in the right mind go and live in a city?
What are some practical skills that you have?
I have?
Yeah.
Myself? I can repair a Jeep if I have to on the road, if I get stranded. For the Barefoot College, I don't have the practical skills that would be useful. But the other skills that I have, which are important to make these practical skills work, is what I have.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India that teach practical skills. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the schools teach hands-on technical skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to mostly illiterate women and men. So you had the Prince and Princess of Wales come visit the Barefoot College. What other visitors have you had?
We had an extraordinary visit of the Dalai Lama to the Barefoot College. I met him in Zurich, and after I gave this presentation, which I've given now to you, he was very interested in wanting to come to the Barefoot College. And I said, Your Holiness, I would like to train 2 Tibetan grandmothers as solar engineers. And he said, I don't believe you. So when I went to Dharamsala in June and I presented these 2 grandmothers to him, he looked at them and said, not possible. Last year, again, His Holiness met these 2 women and he was convinced and he said, I can't believe it, what I've seen today. So can I come to the Barefoot College? So he has never, ever been in a village for 15 years because he's always going all over the world and no one's ever taken him to a very small, small, small village. And for the first time, he actually came to the Barefoot College and met all the grandmothers of the world. And he spent the night in a very small, simple room in the Barefoot College and he loved it.
In addition to the Dalai Lama, who else has visited?
In 1978, we had Bob McNamara and Mac Bundy coming to the Barefoot College. Mac Bundy was the head of Ford Foundation, and McNamara was the head of the World Bank. And they both came and slept on the floor in the village in where we were working. Second visit was John Kennedy, came to the Barefoot College for a week. And he was wearing these very shoes, these fluffy shoes. And I said, John, you shouldn't be wearing these fluffy shoes. He said, no, the American ambassador asked me to do that. So I said, well, I think you might be walking into a thorn. Anyway, the next day he did walk into a thorn and limping away madly and feeling very sorry for himself. So John said, can you take me to a village very far away where they haven't seen a white man? I said, sure, we can. So we took John to this very remote village in the middle of nowhere, and he became a driller. He was actually drilling with our drillers to put in a hand pump, President Kennedy's son. And he was limping away, and so one villager came to him and said, can I ask you a personal question? I said, yeah. He said, yes, sure. He said, do all the Americans walk like that? It's very funny.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Bunker Roy, founder of the Barefoot College. Coming up, we'll meet Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital invitations. Users can choose all the design elements of a card, ranging from font to color, pattern, size, and Paperless Post has delivered more than 60 million invitations and cards since its inception in 2009. Alexa started the company when she was 23 years old with her younger brother, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you describe what Paperless Post is?
Paperless Post it's a website that you go to, and you can design anything that you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, except that you send it all online. Once you've designed it, you put in your recipients' names and email addresses. When you send it to them, they receive it in their inbox, and you can track their RSVPs. And I think the key difference between us and other online invitation companies is that it really looks like what you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, from the texture of the paper stock that the invitation appears to be printed on to the envelope with the receiver's name on it that shows up in their inbox and the animation for the more formal cards.
You co-founded the company with your brother, James. How did the idea for the company originate?
It was the result of a series of conversations that James and I had about various things that we wanted to do together. In the beginning, it was that we wanted to work together on a movie, on a film, so he would be the director and I would be the writer and producer. And then I had an idea for another company where it also involved the internet and a mass customization tool where people would design their own suits, and they would get made in Vietnam and in Hoi An and then get sent to the U.S., Neither one of those panned out, but we kept talking, and James called me one day and had this idea. He said, you know, I think that if this were available, people would use it, and I think that they'd probably pay for it, too. I remember responding and saying, I think that you're right that people would use it. I don't know whether they'd pay for it, but I think that we should do it.
Your brother was at Harvard, where you also had graduated from. Do you know how he came up with this idea at the time?
He was actually planning a birthday party for himself. It was his 21st birthday. He'd ordered palm trees, little mini palm trees for $5 each, and printed cups that said Beach Club. You know, it was in the middle of winter, but it said Beach Club on them. But then when it came around to actually inviting people to the party, he really didn't have very many options because it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks away, and he didn't have people's home addresses, and he didn't really have enough money to spend on printing invitations. But at the same time, he didn't want to use Evite or email, which wouldn't express how cool he knew the party would be. So it was actually out of his own experience that he came up with the idea of paperless post.
What were you doing at the time that also was leading you in the direction of wanting to start an online business?
There are a lot of other thoughts that went into doing this kind of company. One of them is that I was working at an older media company, and I was noticing the difficulties that they were having monetizing their content online. It seemed like a really, really big, scary thing for a lot of people and an opportunity for young people who were looking for an opportunity to be creative and solve a problem that the world needed.
You mentioned you had been working for a traditional older media company. That's CBS. You were Katie Kirk's assistant.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
I had worked with her at the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And the reason I got that job was because I speak Greek and read and write Greek because my mom's family is Greek American. So it was all very roundabout how I ended up there.
When you were at CBS, you did receive a lot of invitations in the mail. Did that influence your thinking that, you know what, maybe this could work?
We did receive a lot of invitations at CBS for Katie. But one of the interesting things was that if people were trying to follow up, they would always do it by email. So it meant that essentially for any invitation, there also had to be a digital version. So all of a sudden, it seemed as though the print version was sort of a formality.
Your brother was very specific about his idea, and he is somewhat of an artist. What is his background in the artistic area?
He's entirely self-taught in terms of visual design and graphic design. His entire life, he's been practicing art. So he was a photographer, he was a painter, coin collector, stamp collector, sculptor. And I remember seeing other people's reaction to the things that he would make. And it would be things that he would make in his room. But I remember seeing my mother's friends at our house and always having the same kind of reaction, being impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I also thought about mm-hmm. when he was telling me about this idea.
Your mom is from Greece.
From Greece via Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how about your father?
My father's from New York City.
What did your parents do? What do your parents do?
My parents are both lawyers. Mm. And my dad now practices real estate. And my mom is actually a in-house counsel at Paperless Post.
You mentioned that your mom is Greek and that you speak Greek. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, languages were the thing that I was that made me most interested in school initially. So I speak and read and write modern Greek, and I speak Spanish, and I also know Latin and ancient Greek as well from school.
How do you think that's informed any of this?
I think it's informed a lot of it because I am really interested in the programming languages that we use, and I've learned enough about each of them to understand what I need to know about how they're used, and that makes my job really fun.
When you say programming languages, you're talking about computer programming languages, the plumbing that goes on behind what you see.
That's right. It's what makes it all work.
Because ultimately, it seems like, as well as being a design-oriented company, Paperless Post is a technology company.
Yeah, and more of that, half the people that work at Paperless Post are software developers.
You were 23 years old when you launched the company, and your brother was 21. How did that help or hurt?
So somebody told us once that one of the things you learn when you start a company is that everything that you think is going to be easy is really hard and takes a really long time, and everything that you think is going to be hard is really hard and takes a really long time. And one of the benefits to being a really young person with very little experience when you start a company is that you really do not have much fear about what's going to go into it, and you have the energy to stay up all night, and you have the fearlessness to write somebody that's more senior than you and ask them to work at your company.
Who was one of the people you wrote letters to, senior executives?
I think it wasn't as much senior executives. Mm-hmm. It was more people that knew things that we didn't know, like very, very good software developers. There's a very important technical culture at our company, and that was really founded and cultivated by Aaron Quint, who is our CTO. And in the beginning, he contracted with Paperless Post, and he really wasn't going to come on and work full-time because he had a really great career contracting. And so hiring people that were really different from us and not being scared to ask them to come work with us, and the fact that we were all young, he's also my age, was definitely a benefit in terms of building the company.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that enables users to email custom-made stationery that wouldn't typically be sent over the internet. Users range from individuals to institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the National Gallery. So you had this moment where you thought, okay, we're gonna give this a try. Your brother was still in college, and you were still working as Katie Couric's assistant. What happened then?
What happened was that it was a process of working backwards from the end product that James had defined, the unit of which was a card that was customized. We worked backwards to understand how you would have that be sent over the internet. We quickly realized that it would be via a design process that a user would be in control of, which meant that we needed to create a tool online that would enable a user to create that end product. On nights and weekends, we would meet with a lot of different people, and we would also spend a lot of alone time in our parents' house, or when he was at school and I was living at my parents' house, laying out and designing what we could do. And for him, that was the card and the cards and the format of the end product. And for me, it was the user interface that would enable users to design those cards.
How did you raise capital in the early days? And how much capital did you need early on if it was just you and your brother?
We didn't raise capital until we launched in 2009. We were able to raise capital because we had traction, because we had users, not because we were telling a story about a future when we would have a product and have users.
Once you launched the site, what were the first invitations you sent out, and how did you get traction initially?
Well, we never sent out invitations. So what happened was that there were people that knew what we were doing and asked us when they could use it. And so I had said to a friend that she could use it by September 30th, and she kept bugging me about using it. She kept bugging me, and finally I gave her a password, and I didn't think she'd be able to use the product or navigate through it. And then she gave me a call a few hours later, and she said, "So did you see what I made?" And I said, "No, I didn't see what you made." And she said, Well, can you just go on the site and log on and look at this invitation? Do you like the font color I chose? Do you like the font I chose? Do you like this? I thought it was really great that I chose that champagne bottle. And so she ended up sending that invitation to, 200 or 220 people. And honestly, there is no other way to describe how people started using Paperless Post other than that party.
What was the party for?
For her 22nd birthday.
One of your board members is Ram Shriram, who was an early investor in Google. How did you meet him?
We actually didn't meet Ram personally. He received an invitation or multiple invitations, and so he ended up going to the homepage of Paperless Post and reading about the About Us, and then maybe doing a little more Googling about us, and then wrote us a really warm email to our help email. We wrote him back, and we ended up having breakfast with him in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital stationery. Paperless Post makes money by selling virtual coins for customizing its cards, and the company became profitable in 2010. Your chief operating officer, Lucy Grayson, helped you define the strategy and the business model for the company. How exactly was she helpful, and how do you make money?
I'd say she's been extremely helpful because she came in and helped us define who we were as a business, not just as a product. By her asking, we had to think really hard about how were we going to make money, and a lot of the options didn't fit with the product we'd created because having ads would have meant interjecting between two people's communication. My brother made the comment in a New York Times article that you would never have a flyer in a wedding invitation, so why would you have an ad on an online wedding invitation? And by April of 2009, we deployed a direct-to-consumer payment model. So I credit Lucy's involvement greatly with our self-definition as a business.
What were some stumbling blocks for you in the early days? You were fortunate in that you had a clear concept for the company and that you got traction pretty immediately. What was harder for you than you thought?
Every business that you create, there's also a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. We did learn along the way that there were a lot of other things a business required to succeed, such as email deliverability, which is one of the most detail-oriented and difficult sets of rules to learn. But James somehow became our in-house email deliverability expert
guru.
I remember Lucy saying early on when James was on a call about email deliverability, she was like, thank you for caring so much. And it was true. It's just out of pure care to learn something like email deliverability. And a lot of things that are not pretty go into creating an actual company.
Paperless Post offers a platform for design partners, ranging from large companies like Crane and Boatman Geller to boutique stationers. But it wasn't always that way. You didn't always have these outsourcing design partners. What were some of the first designs that you and your brother came up with?
One of the first ones was called Saint-Germain, and it was a cream rectangular invitation that had a gold bevel and rounded corners, and it just had a simple script font. And it was extremely formal and actually probably not financially viable to send with paper, but that and a few other invitations. One had a silk black ribbon, and it was sort of a shimmery silver paper stock. That was also very popular. Basically, we started out with this line that was extremely formal, and the interesting thing was that when users saw Paperless Post in the beginning, they just felt that that meant that they could use us for formal things, so they started using us for things like, you know, engagement parties or rehearsal dinners and later on actual weddings. And that wasn't really a core part of our plan, but it was amazing that that happened as a result of the type of cards that we originally started with.
You mentioned, you know, silk shimmery paper stock and liners. Now, we have to remember this is all virtual. What are some other designs you came up with?
One of the famous cards that we started out with was red, and it had black and white zebras jumping across the border, and it was based off of a wallpaper at an Italian restaurant in Midtown called Gino's, which I think is sadly now closed.
On Lexington Avenue in New York City. Paperless Post is effectively making stationery more affordable using a digital medium. For instance, you have a calligrapher named Bernard Meisner, who in the real world, his artwork and his actual cards are very expensive.
Bernard Meisner is one of the best calligraphers in the world. One of the wonderful things about having these design partners was that we could have people like Bernard Meisner, whose cards are normally at the mid-range, $6 per item, allow that type of design to be accessed by people who would not otherwise be able to afford to use it. And basically the reason for that is that we are only offering the design itself and the visual quality and not the cost of producing it in physical form.
You mentioned $6 per item. Do you mean per letter?
Yes.
Who is another artist, designer, that's offered on the site whom you particularly like?
Mr. Boddington is a line that is on Paperless Post. It's a sub-brand of Mr. Boddington, which is an offline artisanal stationer in New York City. The sub-brand is Mr. Boddington's nephew, and it's been incredibly popular.
What does it look like?
It is colorful. It's witty. There's often hand-driven fonts on the cards, and it has its own very distinctive brand. There are colors that are regularly used, like pink and yellow and orange, and you know that it's Mr. Boddington when you see it. It's a really great sort of auger for the future of these design partnerships that we have, because we're actually being able to share a lot of revenue with these really talented designers and offer them a platform to get exposure to lots of visitors.
What was the last invitation you sent?
The last invitation I sent was a Chinese New Year invitation. It was for a dinner party that I'm having tonight. And it was on a card that looks like a gold coin, and it flips, and then there is sort of a witty joke, and then an invitation to dinner at 9.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.